Chapter 2. In the autumn month of September, 1857, wherein is present spare date, two idle apprentices, exhausted by the long, hot summer, and the long, hot work it had brought with it, ran away from their employer. They were bound to a highly meritorious lady named Literature, of fair credit and repute, though, it must be acknowledged, not quite so highly esteemed in the city as she might be. This is the more remarkable, as there is nothing against the respectable lady in that quarter, but quite the contrary, her family having rendered eminent service to many famous citizens of London. It may be sufficient to name Sir William Walworth, Lord Mayor under King Richard II, at the time of Wat Tyler's insurrection, and Sir Richard Whittington, which latter distinguished man and magistrate was doubtless indebted to the lady's family for the gift of his celebrated cat. There is also strong reason to suppose that they rang the Highgate bells for him with their own hands. The misguided young men who thus shirked their duty to the mistress from whom they had received many favors, were actuated by the low idea of making a perfectly idle trip in any direction. They had no intention of going anywhere in particular. They wanted to see nothing, they wanted to know nothing, they wanted to learn nothing, they wanted to do nothing. They wanted only to be idle. They took to themselves, after Hogarth, the names of Mr. Thomas Idle and Mr. Francis Goodchild. But there was not a moral pin to choose between them, and they were both idle in the last degree. Between Francis and Thomas, however, there was this difference of character. Goodchild was laboriously idle, and would take upon himself any amount of pains and labor to assure himself that he was idle. In short, had no better idea of idleness than that it was useless industry. Thomas Idle, on the other hand, was an idler of the unmixed Irish or Neapolitan type, a passive idler, a born and bred idler, a consistent idler, who practiced what he would have preached if he had not been too idle to preach, a one entire and perfect chrysolite of idleness. The two idle apprentices found themselves, within a few hours of their escape, walking down into the north of England. That is to say, Thomas was lying in a meadow, looking at the railway trains as they passed over a distant viaduct, which was his idea of walking down into the north, while Francis was walking a mile due south against time, which was his idea of walking down into the north. In the meantime the day waned, and the milestones remained unconquered. "Tom," said Goodchild, "the sun is getting low. Up, and let us go forward." Quoth Thomas Idle, "I have not done with Annie Laurie yet." And he proceeded with that idle but popular ballad, to the effect that for the bonny young person of that name he would lay him down and die equivalent, in prose, to lay him down and die. "What an ass that fellow was!" cried Goodchild, with the bitter emphasis of contempt. "Which fellow?" asked Thomas Idle. "The fellow in your song. Lay him down and die. Finally he'd show off before the girl by doing that. A sniveler. Why couldn't he get up and punch somebody's head?"
"Whose?"
asked Thomas Idle. "Anybody's. Everybody's would be better than nobody's. If I fell into that state of mind about a girl, do you think I'd lay me down and die?" "No, sir," proceeded Goodchild, with a disparaging assumption of the Scottish accent, "I'd get me up and peach into somebody." "Wouldn't you?" "I wouldn't have anything to do with her," on Thomas Idle. "Why should I take the trouble?" "It's no trouble, Tom, to fall in love," said Goodchild, shaking his head. "It's trouble enough to fall out of it, once you're in it," retorted Tom. "So I keep out of it altogether. It would be better for you if you did the same." Mr. Goodchild, who is always in love with somebody, and not unfrequently with several objects at once, made no reply. He heaved a sigh of the kind which is termed by the lower orders a belisser, apostrophe, and then, heaving Mr. Idle on his feet, who was not half so heavy as the sigh, urged him northward. These two had sent their personal baggage on by train, only retaining each a knapsack. Idle now applied himself to constantly regretting the train, to tracking it through the intricacies of Bradshaw's guide, and finding out where it is now, and where now, and where now, and to asking what was the use of walking, when you could ride at such a pace as that. Was it to see the country? If that was the object, look at it out of the carriage windows. There was a great deal more of it to be seen there than here. Besides, who wanted to see the country? Nobody. And again, whoever did walk? Nobody. Fellows set off to walk, but they never did it. They came back and said they did, but they didn't. Then why should he walk? He wouldn't walk. He swore it by this milestone. It was the fifth from London, so far had they penetrated into the north. Submitting to the powerful chain of argument, Goodchild proposed a return to the metropolis, and a falling back upon Euston Square terminus. Thomas assented with alacrity, and so they walked down into the north by the next morning's express, and carried their knapsacks in the luggage van. It was like all other expresses, as every express is and must be. It bore through the harvest country a smell like a large washing day, and a sharp issue of steam, as from a huge brazen tern. The greatest power in nature and art combined, it yet glided over dangerous heights in the sight of people looking up from fields and roads, as smoothly and unreally as a light miniature plaything. Now, the engine shrieked in hysterics of such intensity, that it seemed desirable, that the men who had her in charge should hold her feet, slap her hands, and bring her to, now, burrowed in two tunnels with a stubborn and undemonstrative energy, so confusing that the train seemed to be flying back in 2 leagues of darkness. Here, were station after station, swallowed up by the express without stopping. Here, stations where it fired itself in like a volley of cannonballs, swooped away 4 country people with nosegays, and 3 men of business with portmanteaus, and fired itself off again, bang, bang, bang. At long intervals were uncomfortable refreshment rooms, made more uncomfortable by the scorn of beauty towards beast, the public, but to whom she never relented, as beauty did in the story, towards the other beast, and where sensitive stomachs were fed, with a contemptuous sharpness occasioning indigestion. Here, again, were stations with nothing going but a bell, and wonderful wooden razors set aloft on great posts, shaving the air. In these fields, the horses, sheep, and cattle were well used to the thundering meteor, and didn't mind. In those, they were all set scampering together, and a herd of pigs scoured after them. The pastoral country darkened, became coaly, became smoky, became infernal, got better, got worse, improved again, grew rugged, turned romantic, was a wood, a stream, a chain of hills, a gorge, a moor, a cathedral town, a fortified place, a waste. Now, miserable black dwellings, a black canal, and sick black towers of chimneys. Now, a trim garden, where the flowers were bright and fair. Now, a wilderness of hideous altars all ablaze. Now, the water meadows with their fairy rings. Now, the mangy patch of unlit building ground outside the stagnant town, with the larger ring, where the circus was last week. The temperature changed, the dialect changed, the people changed, faces got sharper, manner got shorter, eyes got shrewder and harder, yet all so quickly, that the spruce guard in the London uniform and silver lace, had not yet rumpled his shirt collar, delivered half the dispatches in his shiny little pouch, or read his newspaper. Carlisle. Idle and Goodchild had got to Carlisle. It looked congenially and delightfully idle. Something in the way of public amusement had happened last month, and something else was going to happen before Christmas. And, in the meantime, there was a lecture on India for those who liked it, which Idle and Goodchild did not. Likewise, by those who liked them, there were impressions to be bought of all the vapid prints, going and gone, and of nearly all the vapid books. For those who wanted to put anything in missionary boxes, here were the boxes. For those who wanted the Reverend Mr. Podger's artist's proofs, 30 shillings, here was Mr. Podger's to any amount. Not less gracious and abundant, Mr. Codger's also of the vineyard, but opposed to Mr. Podger's, brotherly tooth and nail. Here were guidebooks to the neighboring antiquities, and eke the lake country, in several dry and husky sorts. Here, many physically and morally impossible heads of both sexes, for young ladies to copy, in the exercise of the art of drawing. Here, further, a large impression of Mr. Spurgeon, solid as to the flesh, not to say even something gross. The working young men of Carlisle were drawn up, with their hands in their pockets, across the pavements, 4 and 6 abreast, and appeared, much to the satisfaction of Mr. Idle, to have nothing else to do. The working and growing young women of Carlisle, from the age of 12 upwards, promenaded the streets in the cool of the evening, and rallied the said young men. Sometimes the young men rallied the young women, as in the case of a group gathered round an accordion player, from among whom a young man advanced behind a young woman for whom he appeared to have a tenderness, and hinted to her that he was there and playful, by giving her, he wore clogs, a kick. On market morning, Carlisle woke up amazingly, and became, to the two idle apprentices, disagreeably and reproachfully busy. There were its cattle market, its sheep market, and its pig market down by the river, with raw-boned and shock-headed Rob Roys hiding their lowland dresses beneath heavy plaids, prowling in and out among the animals, and flavoring the air with fumes of whiskey. There was its corn market down the main street, with hum of chaffering over open sacks. There was its general market in the street too, with heather brooms on which the purple flower still flourished, and heather baskets primitive and fresh to behold. With women trying on clogs and caps at open stalls, and Bible stalls adjoining. With Dr. Mantle's dispensary for the cure of all human maladies, and no charge for advice, apostrophe and with Dr. Mantle's laboratory of medical, chemical, and botanical science both healing institutions established on one pair of trestles, one board, and one sun blind. With the renowned phrenologist from London, begging to be favored at 6 pence each, with the company of clients of both sexes, to whom, on examination of their heads, he would make revelations enabling him or her to know themselves. Apostrophe through all these bargains and blessings, the recruiting sergeant watchfully elbowed his way, a threat of war in the peaceful skein. Likewise on the walls, were printed hints, that the Oxford Blues might not be indisposed to hear of a few fine active young men, and that whereas the standard of that distinguished corps is full 6 feet, growing lads of 5 feet 11 need not absolutely despair of being accepted. Scenting the morning air more pleasantly than the buried majesty of Denmark did, Messrs. Idle and Goodchild rode away from Carlisle at 8 o'clock one forenoon, bound for the village of Heskett, Newmarket, some 14 miles distant. Goodchild, who had already begun to doubt whether he was idle, as his way always is when he has nothing to do, had read of a certain black old Cumberland hill or mountain, called Carrock, or Carrock Fell, and had arrived at the conclusion that it would be the culminating triumph of idleness to ascend the same. Thomas Idle, dwelling on the pains inseparable from that achievement, had expressed the strongest doubts of the expediency, and even of the sanity, of the enterprise. But Goodchild had carried his point, and they rode away. Uphill and downhill, and twisting to the right, and twisting to the left, and with old Skiddaw, who has vaunted himself a great deal more than his merits deserve, but that is rather the way of the lake country, dodging the apprentices in a picturesque and pleasant manner. Good, weatherproof, warm, pleasant houses, well white-limed, scantily dotting the road. Clean children coming out to look, carrying other clean children as big as themselves. Harvest still lying out and much rained upon. Here and there, harvest still unreaped. Well-cultivated gardens attached to the cottages, with plenty of produce forced out of their hard soil. Lonely nooks, and wild, but people can be born, and married, and buried in such nooks, and can live and love, and be loved, there as elsewhere, thank God. Mr. Goodchild's remark. By and by, the village. Black, coarse-stoned, rough-windowed houses, some with outer staircases, like Swiss houses, a sinuous and stony gutter winding uphill and round the corner, by way of street. All the children running out directly. Women pausing in washing, to peep from doorways and very little windows. Such were the observations of Messrs. Idle and Goodchild, as their conveyance stopped at the village shoemaker's. Old Carrock gloomed down upon it all in a very ill-tempered state, and rain was beginning. The village shoemaker declined to have anything to do with Carrock. No visitors went up Carrock. No visitors came there at all. Ah, the world ganged away on. The driver appealed to the innkeeper. The innkeeper had two men working in the fields, and one of them should be called in, to go up Carrock as guide. Messrs. Idle and Goodchild, highly approving, entered the innkeeper's house, to drink whiskey and eat oatcake. The innkeeper was not idle enough, was not idle at all, which was a great fault in him, but was a fine specimen of a North countryman, or any kind of man. He had a ruddy cheek, a bright eye, a well-knit frame, an immense hand, a cheery, outspeaking voice, and a straight, bright, broad look. He had a drawing room too, upstairs, which was worth a visit to the Cumberland Fells. This was Mr. Francis Goodchild's opinion, in which Mr. Thomas Idle did not concur. The ceiling of this drawing room was so crossed, and recrossed by beams of unequal lengths, radiating from a center, in a corner, that it looked like a broken starfish. The room was comfortably and solidly furnished with good mahogany and horsehair. It had a snug fireside, and a couple of well-curtained windows, looking out upon the wild country behind the house. What it most developed was, an unexpected taste for little ornaments and knick-knacks, of which it contained a most surprising number. They were not very various, consisting in great part of waxen babies with their limbs more or less mutilated, appealing on one leg to the parental affections from under little cupping glasses. But Uncle Tom was there, in crockery, receiving theological instructions from Miss Eva, who grew out of his side like a wen, in an exceedingly rough state of profile propagandism. Engravings of Mr. Hunt's country boy, before and after his pie, were on the wall, divided by a highly colored nautical piece, the subject of which had all her colors and more, flying, and was making great way through a sea of a regular pattern, like a lady's collar. A benevolent, elderly gentleman of the last century, with a powdered head, kept guard, in oil and varnish, over a most perplexing piece of furniture on the table, in appearance between a driving seat and an angular knife box, but, when opened, a musical instrument of tinkling wires, exactly like David's harp packed for traveling. Everything became a knick-knack in this curious room. The copper tea kettle, burnished up to the highest point of glory, took his station on a stand of his own at the greatest possible distance from the fireplace, and said, "By your leave, not a kettle, but a bijou." Apostrophe the Staffordshire ware butter dish with the cover on, got upon a little round occasional table in a window, with a worktop, and announced itself to the two chairs accidentally placed there, as an aid to polite conversation, a graceful trifle in china, to be chatted over by callers, as they airily trifled away the visiting moments of a butterfly existence, in that rugged old village on the Cumberland Fells. The very footstool could not keep the floor, but got upon a sofa, and therefrom proclaimed itself, an entire leaf of white and liver-colored wool, a favorite spaniel coiled up for repose. Though, truly, in spite of its bright glass eyes, the spaniel was the least successful assumption in the collection. Being perfectly flat, and dismally suggestive of a recent mistake, and sitting down on the part of some corpulent member of the family. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.